Hey there, it's Gary Parrish. It's Sunday night, it's December 11th. Welcome back to the Eye on College Basketball podcast. I got Matt Norlander with me. It's been a few days since we last talked, so we got a lot to get to, including Mike Bray's terrific comments in advance of Notre Dame's loss to Villanova and Duke's destruction of UNLV in Las Vegas that I think doubled. Is Grayson Allen's best game of the season, maybe best game of his career. We'll get into UCLA's impressive win over Michigan on Saturday night. We will get into Carlton Bragg's arrest and big smile mugshot. But I wanted to start with Josh Hart because I anybody who listens to this podcast or who has read anything I've ever written understands how much I love Josh Hart as a college player. And you know this as well, Matt Norlander, because when we were putting together our preseason list, top 101 college basketball players, I had Josh Hart third. The way we did it, we'd submit 10 names. Like, you'd submit 10, I'd submit 10. If they were on both our lists, they'd get put on the main list. Otherwise, they'd have to go back into the deck. And you didn't have Josh Hart in your top 10. I was blown away by that because I had Josh Hart as a first-team All-American, had him as the Big East Player of the Year, had him third on my list behind Grayson Allen and Markel Fultz. And you had on your list, I think he was like 78th. And so he ends up being 13th in our list. And if you fast forward 6 weeks from then, now you're writing a column about how Josh Hart should be the National Player of the Year to date. Boy, it's been an interesting 6 weeks for you. Start out ranking Josh Hart 443rd in the country, and now you think he's the leader of the Player of the Year race. Explain yourself, sir.
I'm going to, and I'll talk so you can keep up here so I can really lay this out. Mm-hmm. When we do our, and I say this every damn October, but let me repeat myself here. When we do our top 101 players list, I do not rank players based on the same criteria that I assign to our preseason All-Americans, because in our top 101 list, I'm looking at players and legitimately and literally saying, who would I take as the best available player, right, you know, among all others, all things considered, purely at the college level. I had Hart like 13th or 14th, not 78th, not 64th, not 43rd, not 22nd.
Felt like 78.
Yeah, I know it did. And by the way, if we made a top 101 list tomorrow, I still would not put Josh Hart top five.
He just got 37 points.
He did. He's
on CBS, network of stars on America's Most Watched Network.
Yeah, I get that, man. He balled out. I'm going to get to that in a second, Parrish. I would still take dudes like Jason Tatum and Markel Fultz and a number of other players. I would take Grayson Allen over him. I still would take those guys before I would take Hart. But
why don't you go take a few Notre Dame players too, the ones you put 37 on, since you're going to be so.
I wouldn't take anyone on Notre Dame over Hart, and I never have. But when you look at what he's done and how he's performed, Villanova is the number one team in the country. It's undefeated. Hart was the first player in 18 years to shoot better than 70% from the floor against the top 10 team and in the same game, score more than 35 and grab more than 10 boards. Shout out to Anton Jameson in 98 for being the most recent player to have that stat line. It's kind of nuts that we went that long in between, but Hart did it.
Hold on, let me stop you for a second. Are you sure Devin Downey never did that 2010?
Shout out to Devin Downey.
Devin Downey. Look it up. I mean, listen, look it up. That's all I'm saying.
I'm going to look it up right now. 2010, Devin Downey. Hold on. Let's look at this stat line. By the way, we still get those tweets. Like, I don't get the Devin Downey thing. It wasn't 2010, by the way. It was 2009. The Kentucky game.
2009, 2010.
The 09-10 season. Okay, yeah. I know what you're saying.
Dude, I have his career memorized.
No, it was 08-09, okay, that they beat Kentucky in 2009, January 31st, 78-77. That was on the road. And then they beat him again at home later that season, 77-59. Devin Downey swept Kentucky that year.
Dude,
legend status.
Don't tell me things I already know.
Okay. So anyway, back to Josh Hart, who is half the player Devin Downey was, to be honest with you.
I won't argue with you there.
He is legitimately the number one candidate for Player of the Year right now. And to me, because it was on the network of stars in a national game against an undefeated ranked team coming off an Elite Eight appearance, I think that Hart has just some cushion right now. Guys like Frank Mason, and certainly Luke Kennard, they're Lonzo Ball, although TJ Leaf is also balling out for UCLA. There are a number of guys that are there, and I'm sure they're going to overtake Hart at some point. Hart might steal it back as well. But to me, that performance was so good that he now – it's hard to argue for anyone else in the here and the now when it comes to Hart.
Devin Downey won 3 of his last 4 games against Kentucky.
Legend. Legend status for life.
Swept Billy Gillespie, then basically ended Billy Gillespie's career, if you want to think about it in those terms. Like, if the conversation ever turns to who ended Billy Gillespie's career, proper answer could be Devin Downey. Beat him both times in that 2008-2009 season, Billy Clyde's last season as the head coach of Kentucky Wildcats. Then Kentucky goes out, hires John Calipari. They're like, we'll fix this Devin Downey problem. No, sir. Beat him again. And then finally, they got Kentucky got a win over Devin Downey. But he went 3-1 his last 2 years against Kentucky, Devin Downey. Did. Shout out to Devin Downey. What were we talking about?
We were talking about how Josh Hart is the number one
candidate
for player of the year. And do you disagree with that?
No, except, I mean, like, here, this is where I run into a problem. I don't disagree with Josh Hart. Like, if you voted Josh Hart, you know, National Player of the Year today, like, there's no way to intelligently argue against that. Problem becomes, like, I had Lonzo Ball number one last week. Whether that's right or wrong or whatever, I mean, I could give you my pitch. But, like, Lonzo Ball's still awesome. UCLA's still undefeated. I don't know that Lonzo Ball deserves to drop, but, like, Lonzo Ball didn't put 37 on Notre Dame Saturday either. So, yeah, I've got to do a Player of the Year rankings update this week, and I might have Josh Hart number one, and if I do, that'll be probably the most sensible thing I do all week.
I think that's fair, and, yeah, Ball's team was terrific. I know we'll get to them in just a minute. Real quick on Nova GP. Notre Dame came out and just kind of smacked him in the face there. It was a tremendous first half for the Irish. They were hitting tough shots. They were getting into the lane. Matt Farrell, who basically looks like Jeff Borzello's cousin, was going off. And it was kind of a revelation to see Notre Dame continue to play that kind of offense at that kind of level, because it was by far their toughest opponent. So I think we learned plenty about Notre Dame and what it can do or can't do. Nova pushing back, I thought, was an inevitability, and Hart played tremendously, but he did get help in spots where he needed it from his teammates overall. And why I think Hart will be consistently, I mean, at worst, and it's going to be, I think, a loaded field in terms of who will consider for player of the year, but Hart's never going to fall out of the top five, because I don't see Villanova not being a top 15 team start to finish. Like, I don't think Nova's going to lose 3 in a row. I doubt it will lose 2 in a row, and because of that, it's just not going to fall far in the rankings. And because, you know, it's an East Coast team, the reigning national champions, he's so damn good. I expect Hart to be a consistent top 5 candidate for player of the year, and for Villanova to put itself on the right track to another really, really good seed, which is no shock. We said coming in that this was probably going to be the best team in the Big East with probably some pushes, and that league is good. I mean, they're going to lose some games, but I thought it was pretty damn impressive for them to push back the way they did, get some stops, and they needed all of what Hart gave them. But in the right spots, Jenkins had a few big buckets. Mikhail Bridges was pretty damn important. I feel like that's a go back, watch the game film, and Jay Wright will see just how much Bridges contributed there. But on the whole, I'm feeling better and better about Villanova, and they are very much right there with kind of any other team that you want to look at that should be considered, you know, national title winning worthy. There's no reason to believe that this team is going to have a drop off from last season.
No, they're going to take a loss every once in a while. Like, they might lose at Creighton, you know, lose at Xavier, but, you know, lose at Butler. But they ain't going to lose much. Like, you know, over under right now, heading into the NCAA tournament, 3.5 losses. What would you do with Villanova?
That's,
by the way, they're going into Big East play tough, undefeated, because they got the next game's at Temple at home, American at home. They're going to be 12-0 heading into the Big East. Then it gets interesting because they've got at Creighton, at Butler, back-to-back.
I know.
So, like, so that gets tough.
That's tricky. But that's the only, like, that's the only,
I think if you gave me 3 spot, and a half,
I would say over. GP, I'll say over.
I might go under.
4 losses for Villanova on Selection Sunday. 4 losses, I think, is fair. They also got to play Virginia, but that game is in Philly. And who knows what Virginia will be at that point. They have a three-game road stand in February. Xavier, DePaul, Seton Hall. They should win two of those, I would think. But we'll see. Maybe Seton Hall will be formidable at that point. But I'm going to say Nova is a four-loss team, Big East tournament play included, on Selection Sunday. Yeah. And with that kind of record and what it's done in the non-conference, winning at Purdue, getting a win over a Notre Dame team that'll be in the tournament, four losses will probably be enough to get them a one seed. Obviously, it will depend on what happens around them in the sport.
I think four losses make sense. Like, I think that's the. I think if I were setting a number, that's the number. Four. And then we could argue over or under, but four is probably the number. But if they do go to Selection Sunday with four or fewer losses, I think that obviously, like you pointed out, it'll depend on what happens elsewhere. But my guess is a four-loss Villanova team on Selection Sunday, as the reigning national champions, and I know it's not supposed to matter, but, like, you know, those are humans in that room. Like, the reigning national champions coming off another Big East championship with only four losses, that's probably a one seed. I would feel safe thinking that's a one seed in the NCAA tournament.
Agreed.
I do want to talk about heading into that game. It was interesting. Mike Bray held a press conference. He, of course, is the Notre Dame coach, and said he was looking forward to this game with Villanova-Notre Dame on CBS because – it would give people a chance to focus on veterans and winning programs, established programs, people who have done it, you know, not only this year, but last year, year before, instead of talking about, you know, a lottery pick freshman who might play before Christmas. That was clearly in reference to Harry Giles, and another lottery pick freshman who's getting his butt beat. That was the quote that presumably was directed at Markel Fultz out at Washington, whose team was at the time 4-4. And it sort of got twisted into Mike Bray's taking a shot at Markel Fultz, taking a shot at Harry Giles, taking a shot at Duke, whatever. When in reality, he was just taking a shot at us, not you and I specifically. I mean, maybe it could have been because, like, we're just as guilty as anybody else talking about Harry Giles and Markel Fultz nonstop. He was just taking a shot. It wasn't a shot at Duke or Giles or Fultz as much as it was a shot at people who – talk about and write about college basketball, which includes us. And I thought it was completely fair. I even texted Mike and I was like, I love that comment. A, because I just like it when coaches say interesting things, but he was spot on. And I do think that sometimes we do get a little carried away, and we probably will on this podcast and many more going forward, talking about, you know, the guys who project as lottery picks instead of just really focusing on, you know, more traditional college basketball teams who, you know, aren't loaded with one and dones or loaded with top five picks, but are still really, really good consistently. And that very much is the case with Villanova and Notre Dame. Like, Mike might be one of the more underappreciated coaches in America, given what he's consistently done with that Notre Dame program. So I just thought it was, A, some interesting comments, but B, they sort of got twisted a little bit, and I thought they were perfectly fair. Like, I don't like... I'm not a big fan of just people blaming the media, criticizing the media in general or while speaking in generalities. But like, that was a shot at people like us. Not a shot, but it was a comment in our direction. And I thought it was completely fair. Like, it didn't offend me at all because, like, you know, he's really just holding up a mirror to the way college basketball is covered these days.
I had zero issue with what Mike said. There was a lot of truth to it, but also, to be fair, the fact of the matter is this is the most exciting freshman class in a long time in college basketball. So we have every right to write, cover, report, and discuss those things because these players will only be in our sport for all of 8 months. And why not take advantage of it? But at the same time, Bray has also become quite good at cultivating a program. You know, Demetrius Jackson and Zach August last year. The year before that, you had Jaron Grant, Pat Connaughton, Demetrius Jackson, all these guys that have been good players entering college, but not necessarily surefire draft picks, and he turns them into pros. It just takes him 2-3, usually 4 years, and in the process has created really one of the more reliable offenses in the country. Bray is now just starting to get his due because he didn't have a lot of tournament success until recent years, and so he had teams over, you know, the past 15 years or so who performed relatively well on the whole in the regular season, but then failed to get to the second weekend of the tournament. That has not been the case in recent years. Obviously, Notre Dame almost knocked off undefeated Kentucky a couple years back, and then last year they make it to the Elite Eight again. So now he's breaking through and getting some gains in the tournament and is rightfully starting to get respect as really a top 20, top 25 coach overall in the sport, which is tough to do, but he is absolutely worthy of it. And by the way, GP, I don't know, I'm sure you picked up on this, but what I thought was interesting was that he chose to make these comments, and to me it was 100% toward the media. It wasn't a shot at Duke whatsoever, because let's remember, Bray used to coach on that bench with Krzyzewski. He was an assistant for a long time there before he left to coach at Delaware and then at Notre Dame, and so he's not going to take a shot at Krzyzewski. He doesn't have any issue with Harry Giles or anything, or Jason Tatum. It wasn't about that at all. Very much am open to coaches taking shots. And by the way, you get them, I get them. A lot of people in the media get messages. Coaches read a lot, okay? They read a lot. They consume a lot of college basketball media because this is their life. And some coaches don't. Like, some coaches generally don't give an F what the media has to say. They don't bother themselves with it. But we do regularly hear from coaches about a story we might have written or something, you know, that you might have done with ranking teams and whatever. And I like the fact that they're interested in it and have no problem pushing back sometimes when they, you know, will come at me in a fun way, just kind of like, hey, Norlander, what the hell was this? Like, what, you know, it's good to at least have that kind of interest and know that the things that we're talking about can reverberate there, because obviously the things that they do, the games that they coach, the sport that they build their lives around, are they create our livelihood. So I encourage any coach to be willing to speak out about these kind of things, like, just because it gets the discourse going. It's good that we're just having conversations like this, because you know what? Notre Dame is better than I thought they were going to be. I was wrong about this team. They showed themselves well against Villanova. They're probably going to be a top six team in the ACC this season, and I did not think that would be the case this year. I thought that they would have a drop-off from last season, probably qualify for the tournament, but maybe just barely get in, be in that top 8-9 range in the ACC. But they're even better than that, man. I mean, Bonzi Colson is damn good. I love watching that guy play, and he's got plenty around him with Vastori and Vijay Beacham, most notably. We talked about Farrell's breakout performance. So here to Mike Bray. By all means, if any other coaches have an issue with the fact that we can't shut up about Fultz and Dennis Smith and the Duke guys and De'Aaron Fox and Malik Monk, speak up. But just know that fans are interested in that. We know the things that they're looking to see and read about, and the fact that these freshmen are that interesting and fun. Like, UCLA is a freaking blast to watch. Like, obviously, we're going to be writing and talking about that. But in the course of that, we can and will give credit to the coaches and programs that are winning without dudes that are 18 years old.
You mentioned Duke. They did play on Saturday. They went to Las Vegas and beat UNLV by, like, a million points. Grayson Allen was terrific. Finished with a career high, I believe, 34. Certainly his best game of the season. And not only did he play well, like, he looked well. You know, he's had a toe problem that still isn't, he said afterward, 100%, but it's better. And he was explosive. Like, the one dunk I think at this point everybody has seen was just like, whoa. Like, it was, you know, that was like a dunk of the year type candidate, because it was, you know, on a big stage. I guess any stage Duke is on is a big stage, but on national television. And he really, he got violent with it. And you just watch that team, and I don't want to get repetitive about Duke, because we talked a lot about this last week on the most recent podcast, but man, they are really, really looking like something. And the point I made and something I wrote was that really, I just copied what I said on the podcast last week, which is they might end up being better than we thought. And we thought they were the consensus best team in America. And the reason they might end up being better is because Luke Kennard's so much better than anybody anticipated, and Emile Jefferson so much better than anybody anticipated. Jason Tatum is still like a top five pick, maybe number one pick in the draft. Marquise Bolden is still whatever he is. Like, I don't even know that he's going to be that important to this team. Grayson Allen can still do what he did this past weekend. But when you start talking about, we looked at them on paper, and they look like the best team in the country, but then they're even better than they were on paper, at least individually. And it's not just individually, because, like, they're playing well as a team, sharing the ball, guarding, doing all the things you want a team to do. But, like, Grayson Allen is what we expected him to be. Certainly when he gets healthy, he appears like he's going to be that. And now Duke doesn't play again for more than a week, so he's got time to get healthy. Frank Jackson, better than we thought. Luke Kennard, better than we thought. Emile Jefferson, better than we thought. Jason Tatum, still early, but there's no reason I think he's going to be anything other than awesome. And, like, I want to see Harry Giles, and I think he will obviously be great, because I think he's great. But, like, even if you told me Harry Giles never played a single minute, who do you pick for national champion right now? I'd still pick Duke. That's, how about that? You could tell me that the guy who 6 months ago or a year ago everybody thought would be the number one pick in the draft isn't even going to play for Duke, and it wouldn't change my opinion of Duke winning the national championship at all. That's how talented and deep they are.
Yeah, I'll take the Grayson Allen just singularly here, GP, because I don't think I shared on the last podcast. Just a little more anecdotes and on the scene. So I saw them in person last week, and I talked with Grayson in the locker room afterward, and the toe was bothering him. He didn't have a good night shooting. He was harshly self-critical. I would define him as being frustrated, and that entirely being on himself. And just I think he was frustrated by his lack of mobility, the fact that he wasn't getting shots off that he wanted to get off. Overall, had a good distribution night, but that dunk to me was an FU dunk to kind of himself being like, yeah, I know I can do this. Like, it was a week's worth of being pissed, and he finally got it out. And that was really one hell of a dunk. And it reminds us, by the way, Grayson Allen is a freaking athlete and can get up and is one of the best dunkers in the sport. I think some of that gets overshadowed with the fact that he suddenly become the star at Duke and a player that people love to hate. But
Because he's white.
I know, exactly. Now we're going to get more of that with Kennard.
He was the dunk champion at the McDonald's All-American game. He won the dunk contest.
Yeah, no, he's a fantastic player. So him having a game like that, I think, is really important for him to get back on track. It was just a reminder. I said this on the podcast. They can just roll out one of these dudes on any given night, and they're going to kill you. Like, they are now reaching a point where they've got four guys legitimately capable of putting up more than 30 on you, and it's not like that's going to be necessarily just like a complete revelation. So for Grayson, I think it was a big time deal. I mean, they more than doubled up Vegas, and Vegas, that's a rebuilding team. Marvin Menzies is in his first year. It's going to be years before they can even think about cracking back into the ranking. So it was a little depressing that this was the first time those two teams met since 91 in the Final Four, when Duke got its revenge on that epic blowout in the 90 Final Four. But on the whole, that was just a get-right game for Grayson, and now they have more than a week. He'll probably be fully healthy when they play Tennessee State on Monday, December 19th. I do expect Harry Giles to make his debut in that game.
Like, UNLV is a mess right now. They're in total rebuild, and who knows if they'll ever get where they need to be, but I don't care. You beat somebody by 40. You beat a brand like UNLV by 49 points. Like, you're operating at a really high level. So, like I wrote, Duke should not be ranked number one, I don't think, because I believe the results have to matter, and they do have a loss to Kansas on the resume. They do not have a truly great win, or at least they don't have a win over a truly great team. The way some other, you know, like, they don't have a win that matches UCLA's win at Kentucky. Probably nobody does. You can rank them number one, and I won't argue with you because I do think they're the best team. But, like, that's my point. I'm not ranking them number one right now, but if you want to start an NCAA tournament tomorrow, you can put them in any region. You can make them any seed you want. I'll take those guys. They're really operating at a high level. Also, though, UCLA operating at a high level, improved to, what did they go to, 10-0?
Yeah.
They're 10-0 now after a wild game against Michigan. They were actually tied at the half, down for some of the first half, tied at the half 50-50, and only tied because Lonzo Ball hit a long three-pointer. And then they just kept scoring. Like, you know, if you're Michigan, you're going, okay, like, we just put up 50, we should be all right. Except, no, they put up 52. And then you get in the second half, and, like, you know, I think Michigan scored 84. And you feel pretty good about on the road, Pauley Pavilion, nope, they're going to put 102 on you. And they're right now leading the country, UCLA is, in two-point field goal percentage, in three-point field goal percentage. Lonzo Ball is awesome. TJ Leaf is awesome. Like what Lonzo's doing is completely overshadowing what TJ Leaf's doing. But, like, TJ Leaf is playing unbelievably well for a freshman or for anybody. I'm actually going out to LA this week, and can't wait to get out there. A, because it's LA, the weather's terrific. But I mean, this UCLA team has become, I think, maybe the most interesting team in the country. If only because, you know, they went 15-17 last year. People were on Steve Alford pretty harshly, and now he's got a team that's ranked second in the country and a difference maker at point guard, shooters all around. Like, I didn't look at the numbers this morning. But I think heading into the Michigan game, they had five players shooting better than 40% from three-point range. I don't mean just like – and that's not counting somebody who like has taken 2 3-pointers. Like five dudes who legitimately – who play real minutes and shoot jumpers from the perimeter, and they've got five of them that were shooting over 40% from three. I mean, that's a fun basketball team. And not just fun, because that implies not great. I think they're fun, and I think they're great.
This team is – you are on the money. I mean – yeah, Villanova rightfully should be number one right now. Duke should be considered the most talented and frightening team. UCLA is in the conversation with any team in America as a Final Four national title threat. I don't think, and this is going to be hard to keep up, and maybe they will do it, maybe they won't. I don't think there's ever been a team that's ever led the country in both 2- and 3-point percentage. Maybe it's happened. I'm going to research it and look it up. That's bonkers. They're shooting 47% from three as a team, which is outstanding.
And, I just looked it up now. They do still at this point. Isaac Hamilton, TJ Leaf, Bryce Alford, Lonzo Ball, Aaron Holiday, all shooting at least 42% from 3-point range. They have an unbelievable point guard who makes everybody better, and they surround them with basically four shooters on the court at all times.
I mean, that's they at least have three.
It's Lonzo and 3 3-point shooters on the court at all times.
And given how savvy Lonzo is, and by the way, he's a big guy. He's not a super athlete, but he's athletic. Like, I don't want to undersell like how good Lonzo is. And they move the ball so well. And by the way, they run. Don't get me wrong. Like, they can get up and down, but it's more like they quickly get into their half court set, and then they move it, and they push, and they find the spot, and they trigger, and they go. So they're a ton of fun. They had a bonkers, just laughably ridiculous first half against Michigan, where the teams combined to hit like 23 three-pointers and were on pace to set the record. Now, they didn't do it, but that was punctuated by Ball hitting a shot from like 30 feet at the end of the first half, which kind of just shows a microcosm of what he is and what the team is. So, yeah, I mean, I'm super excited to read what you get from that team, because it's been a long time since UCLA has been this good and fun to watch. Let's remember that the Howland teams were good, but they freaking grinded, okay?
Not the last team. Led the Pac-12 in tempo.
GP, can you let me finish a damn sentence here? I know that the last team was good, but people listening are going to think about the Final Four teams, and those teams, while efficient, basically pounded you into dust. They didn't play fast. They had great athletes and future NBA players on them. But a common criticism of Howland with the Final Four teams is that they had the potential to be closer to what we see with this year's UCLA team, but they never came to be that. And Howland won with his style the way he wanted to do it and had a ton of success with it. The irony was, and this is what I was getting to,
I'm not going to let you disparage the name of Ben Howland on this podcast.
Honey, before you cut me off, the irony with Howland is at the end of his UCLA tenure, the team was good in the league, was fun to watch, had some good potential, started running and gunning, but they still kicked him out anyway. And now it's taken a few years for Alford to get his guys into the system. And now they are just the epitome of must watch. They are as good as any other program to simply watch on television at the college level. And they are reaching the must, like, people are going to want to see Duke, and they're going to want to see Kentucky and UCLA. Those are the top three. Like, okay, I want to see these teams because I don't know what's going to happen. And whenever it does, it's probably going to be great.
What was interesting about the last year at UCLA is Ben scrapped everything he had ever done and just said, okay, they want me to play fast. Let's play fast. It was like there were three criticisms of Ben as his UCLA tenure started unfolding. One was that recruiting had dropped off. The other was that the winning had dropped off. And the other was that they played a boring style of basketball. So in that last year, they won the Pac-12 outright, played the fastest tempo in the Pac-12, and had like, top two, top three recruiting class in America, still got fired. Whatever. Here's my point. So they go out and hire Steve Alford, which is so like it was hilarious to me because they said, we want a coach who's going to commit to running and, play a fun style. And they would go out and hire Steve, who, for all his success at both Iowa and New Mexico, like they did, they, he never played fast. And so I was just like, you want to play an exciting brand of basketball and you hire Steve? Like, that's not what, that's not it, like.
Right. Remember what Andy Enfield said that, you know, got leaked. Cause he said it around a reporter that he didn't think would publicize it. And Andy Enfield basically slammed UCLA for, you know, kind of playing grind at ball and USC not being that. So yeah, you're on the right track.
Yeah. No, because he said, like the quote was something along the, like he was in a practice and he was getting his guys to run. And he's like, if you want to play slow, go to UCLA, go across town. We run here. And that was a shot at Steve. My point being, like, you look, like, I give Steve all the credit in the world. Cause like, they're not playing that way now. They are running and it is, it's awesome. Like, you know, it's funny. And I guess this happens every college basketball season, but you know, the storylines just emerge from wherever they emerge. But like already, like we're literally a month into it. It's a month we've been doing this now. And we've got the Baylor best resume in the country story that nobody saw coming. We've got UCLA as the most fun team in the country that I don't know that many saw coming. We've got Duke starting to look overwhelming, which I think most people saw coming, but maybe not. If I would have told you Harry Giles and Jason Tatum and Marcus Bolden were going to miss much of the first month, like there really are some nice storylines that have already developed. And that is one of the things about college basketball. Like the storylines emerge, you know, you don't always know where they're coming from, but they always pop up. And we've got some really good ones involving big, big brands this year. Like you look at the top, you know, and it's, you know, we're talking about UCLA. We're talking about Kentucky. We're talking about Duke. We're talking about North Carolina. I know that the so-called off brands don't always enjoy that, but like for the sport, when you have these types of brands, you know, making the most headlines, that is good for the sport of college basketball.
You're gonna be ticking Mike Bray off again, man.
I love
it. You're gonna anger the turtleneck.
No, I think as long as we don't bring up Markelle Fultz on this podcast, we're gonna be fine. So we're not even gonna do it. Like I think Markelle Fultz is playing tonight. I wouldn't know. I'm not even paying attention. Mike Bray, don't worry about it. No idea. I have no idea. Markelle Fultz could score 40. He could be doing it right now. I have no idea. I'm not even paying attention to him anymore. Mike Bray, he sent a message. I accepted the message. Markelle Fultz is out of my head right now.
All right. So it was not a stacked, loaded weekend. We had Carolina get a scare, by the way, from Tennessee and was able to pull it out. Joel Berry wasn't in that game. But, you know, winning that game certainly adds more shine to the Kentucky-Carolina CBS Sports Classic. We'll get to that later in the week. But aside from that, GP, I mean, what else really went down that you think is worth discussing?
See, there weren't very many good games. Like, you know, Butler beat Cincinnati, but, like, whatever. You know,
that was one that Butler dodged, you know, just Xavier dodged losing three in a row. Butler gets a win over Cincinnati.
I'll tell you this. So obviously I update the top 25 in one college basketball rankings every single day. And there was no change from Saturday to Sunday. Like, and I think that might be the first Saturday ever that I can remember where nothing needed to be changed. Like Butler beat Cincinnati, but I had Butler ranked ahead of Cincinnati. It was a close game for most of the game. So like, there's no reason to drop Cincinnati. They're like, I don't want to say I have any steadfast rules, but like, I never find it sensible to punish a team for losing to a higher ranked team on the road. So I wasn't going to punish Cincinnati for that. You know, there was another one where somebody lost, but it was like, what are you going to do? BYU got a nice win. I actually watched it last night. I was in New York this weekend for CBS Sports Network, but I got back to my hotel and was able to get in front of the TV for Colorado BYU, and that's a you know, if the WCC ever wants to try to be a three bid league, like they need BYU to get wins like that. Mm-hmm. So that was a pretty good win for them. But Saturday was and Sunday as well. As we're talking, like there haven't been any massive upsets from the weekend involving relevant teams. It just the weekend didn't go down like that, and a lot of it is because of scheduling. This is the time of year where there aren't many great matchups because everybody's or most people are in finals and wrapping up semesters. And so I think to the extent that it might have been a boring weekend, it's got a lot to do with the academic schedule as much as anything else.
Agree. And it will hits a big lull this week. I mean, there are games, but there are not as many enticing ones. But this is really once you hit into the, you know, December 10th to 20th range. Thankfully, we'll have the games out in Vegas with the CBS Sports Classic. this weekend, but this is really a time to start looking. That's why I did the tournament resumes post last week. I'll do that this week. I think I might do that weekly, just kind of look at top 10, top 15 resumes, because we can start looking at a lot of what's happened in the non-conference to this point. A lot of those things matter, and we're through them. Now, there's still big ones remaining, you know, and into the season, like Kansas, Kentucky will be in January. Villanova, Virginia will be in January. So there are still, you know, we're dotted with important non-conference games, but we are basically 70%, 75% through the non-conference portion of the schedule already. So we can start taking a look around at what's been accomplished and achieved. And you with your rankings, you know, it's a combination of what's been done on the floor and a projection from the preseason. And, you know, soon enough, December will be over. The conference season starts, you know, around the 28th, 29th in almost every league. And then we'll really be in it. So this is a little bit of, you know, the doldrums this week, but overall, yeah, it has been a fun start to the season, and the biggest blue blood programs continue to win big. And I think that will be something that remains a prominent storyline going forward.
Yeah. As I was mentioned, like having all these big brands at the top, I forgot one obvious one, which is Kansas. I mean, Duke operating at a high level, Kentucky, North Carolina, UCLA, Kansas, of course, doing what Kansas does. But they were in the headlines for bad reasons. I guess it went down on Friday. Carlton Bragg Jr., yes, the sophomore forward, was arrested and charged with battery stemming from an incident with his girlfriend. If you read the statement from the police department there in the Lawrence, Kansas area, he's accused of striking her, of pushing her down some stairs. She's the one that called 911, so this isn't a situation where some neighbors overheard a ruckus and called and like, you know, she was in a bad enough spot, you know, presumably, to call 911. The investigators, as they are, found her believable enough for whatever reason to charge him with a Class B misdemeanor, but still a very serious crime. And he's been suspended, going to be held out while they're gathering facts, whatever that means. But just an unfortunate story. I mean, this is something that has always been bad, but it certainly is perceived in a different way today than it used to be. I mean, I can tell you, you know, well before I got to CBS, or at least a few years before I got to CBS, I covered the University of Memphis basketball program, and a young man named Jeremy Hunt was arrested and charged after beating up his ex-girlfriend. And I mean, he beat her up. I mean, I went and saw her injuries and, you know, spoke to her, and it was ugly. And I think he missed two games. Like, it was just like, and there was some media criticism, but it wasn't like on Outside the Lines or anything like that. But now if you try to bring back somebody who is accused of hitting a woman and put them on your basketball team, like you're like Bob Lee is talking about you in the middle of the day. So it's like, you know, Carlton Bragg, you know, I don't feel sorry for him. Like, if he did this, he deserves whatever punishment he gets. But you talk about somebody throwing away some real opportunities, because this doesn't just affect his status at Kansas. Like, this affects his NBA draft status to the extent that it existed. This is somebody who has, like, really messed his life up now. And what a ugly headline to read on Friday night.
Yeah, I got a few thoughts on this, GP. One, it is interesting that as you're talking about this, I was just trying to catch up. We're recording this late on Sunday night, and I'm scrolling through my Twitter feed, and there's a story now out about a Heisman finalist, Dede Westbrook, at Oklahoma. Oklahoma's actually had its issues with domestic violence within its program, and now the Tulsa World is reporting that there have been two incidents with Dede Westbrook in the past where he's had violence within his family and officially logged complaints. And so this is something that is far too prominent in sports at any level, and it certainly still infiltrates and infects college sports. Carlton Bragg's mugshot is an awful look, because it's him smirking, if not smiling, after this, and it will garner no sympathy.
Like, it really is just like just the worst look ever. Like, I don't know how you're supposed to look when you're taking a mugshot for being accused of beating up your girlfriend or striking your girlfriend. I don't want to overstate what happened, but like, I know that ain't the way to look. I don't know the right way to look, but it ain't that.
It's not good. And listen, I know that there's still information that will need to be brought to light with this, but the fact of the matter is, you know, when things like this happen, we need to take seriously, just as seriously, the words of the alleged victim as we would the party that's being accused. And in the past, I don't think that was necessarily always the case. And certainly that could be argued in the form of action or lack thereof when you speak specifically of Jeremy Hunt only getting two games. So it's right. People that push back on this being some sort of push toward a PC culture, no, man. Like, hitting women is never okay, ever. You're scum if you do it. I mean, this stuff gets me heated. It really does. And so, like, if Bragg did this, I have zero issue with him never playing for Kansas again. Like, I don't care about if there might have been some heated argument because there was, you know, cheating involved with another guy or whatever, like, whatever details that really are inconsequential to me. Like, if you're getting physical with a woman, the punishment, I don't care. You can be kicked off the team. I don't care. Maybe that's not that bad. Maybe Self winds up sitting him down for 10 games, whatever punishment he feels is appropriate. And by the way, Self does not mess around. You've been in his practices. I've been in his practices. Like, he is a tough teacher of the Izzo school. And it wouldn't shock me if Bragg, like, truly effed up here and he's hitting serious charges and could be, you know, dealing with significant punishment for the law, like, then maybe that's it. And if you want to talk about what it means to Kansas from a basketball perspective, I got no problem doing that. But it's not wrong when we discuss these things to keep at the forefront of the discussion, like, this is garbage human behavior and we should never stand for it. And a lot of coaches, unfortunately, this is the reality of the business. When they recruit these guys and they have these guys, they pray that they don't get screw ups that like to hit women, because this is like some of the worst stuff that you can run into as a coach. You don't want guys on your team, 18, 19, 20 year olds, who are young men, athletic, talented. Some will have inflated egos. Some, you know, they're going to be getting into situations where they're going to parties, they're drinking. Like, this is just nightmare stuff. Oh, coach, you got a phone call. Your player's in jail because he's beating a woman. Like, that's just the last thing they want to be dealing with. And it's something that every coach in America is worried about. So we'll see where the story goes from here, but it wouldn't shock me if what we have here is a serious case against Bragg, if Self says you're never playing for me again. That wouldn't shock me. It might not go that way, but I wouldn't have a problem with it if it was indeed, if that ended up being the case.
Right. And, you know, I had some people on Twitter as I wrote about this on Friday talking about, you know, innocent till proven guilty. And like, hey, nobody's trying to I'm not throwing anybody in jail. That's what I think sometimes people don't understand what innocent until proven guilty means. It means that we're not going to, like, give you a sentence for battery. Like, you know, nobody's going to throw, like, Carlton Bragg in jail for 6 months without being found guilty. Of course, and until proven guilty. But, like, playing college basketball, representing a university like Kansas, a brand like the Jayhawks, that's a privilege. And that can and should be taken away from you if you are involved in an incident like this. Obviously, if it is all a fabricated story from the accuser, then that is the worst thing in the world, and I hope she is punished in some way. But that doesn't seem to be what this is about.
That almost never.
It's almost never. It's almost like when there's a sexual assault allegation, and they say, well, you know, she could just be making it up. Yeah, she could just be making it up. Except there are people who study these crimes, and what they find out is that it almost never happens. Yeah, you could win the lottery, but you probably won't. Yeah, she could be making it up, but history shows that she probably isn't. And as it relates to this specific case, literally nobody, even Carlton Bragg, has said that this didn't happen. You know, like, nobody said, I can't wait to tell my side of the story. I can't wait to, you know, I never laid a hand on anybody. Like, I haven't heard that at least. So it appears to be what it is. And regardless of what, it is certainly enough to where police, you know, he's been charged with a crime. Again, I'm with you. I'm not going to pretend that I know how to handle this exactly if I'm Bill Self, that it should end somebody's career or it should be a 1-year suspension. Like, I don't know that there's a clear cut, perfect answer for this. But if they do decide he can never wear that uniform again, I won't be the guy to write the column that says, give Carlton Bragg a second chance. You can have a second chance on life. You can have a second chance in another relationship. But, you know, if you lose your athletic career over something like this, well, then be a better person.
Yeah, I agree. And I'll just tag it with this and we can wrap it up. I mean, if if this was a one-time thing, if Brad and what's been alleged happened, Bragg admits to it, apologizes, shows true remorse, endures a punishment on, you know, within the program and the law, I've got no problem with self giving him a second chance. But we are rightfully now approaching, within this greater discussion of sports, as people that write about it, cover it, talk about it, punditry and all that stuff, it should be given a more serious tone, and it shouldn't necessarily be, not even necessarily, it should not be when something like this happens, how does it affect Kansas' basketball team? We can ask that question, but it shouldn't be the first question that we ask, because it's not the most important part of about the topic. That's all. This thing just gets me. It just really riles me up when you got these players and you got athletes and we have a domestic violence issue in the country. It really bothers me, and so I'm just sick of it in the news, and I just don't get how human beings can act this way.
As much as you and I disagree on Josh Hart, we agree on this completely. Remember, you can subscribe to the Ion College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. That's the best way to get the latest episodes as quickly as possible. So please do that. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you again middle of the week. I will probably be in LA at that point, so that'll be nice. Till then, take care.